morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to episode 79 of the Cloudcast. We are back and coming to you live from our massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And tonight we are joined by our very first member of the Cloudcast Five Timers Club. So, Mr. Nick Weaver, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys. How are we doing?
Good. We're good. Aaron, how are you doing tonight, man?
I'm doing good, man. Doing good.
Good. And we're also joined by one of Nick's DevOps members. And what we found is we've had before, we've had the president of the private cloud, we've had the most interesting man in the cloud, and tonight we've got the friendliest man in DevOps. We're really excited to have Gene Kim on tonight. Gene, welcome.
Hey, glad to be on. I've actually never heard that title before, but delighted to win it. Woohoo!
Well, you know, I tell you what, man. So two things. One, I've never ever seen. You know, you see pictures of people all the time, and bio pictures and headshots. Yours always has this just enormous smile on it, and like it's not just like a little one. I mean, you're just happy about what you do, which is very cool. And the other thing, Gene is our very first. So typically when we have guests, and Aaron knows this and Nick knows this, we tend to reach out to folks because we think they're very, very interesting. And obviously we try and find everybody we can. Gene was our very first, like, demanded by our listeners, and not by one or two listeners, but like a ton of people said, you know, why in the world haven't you had Gene on the show and you're starting to talk about DevOps? So this should be not only a very good show, but hopefully, you know, we're doing what our listeners want us to do. So glad to have you on, Gene.
Oh, right on. No, delighted to be here.
So we were joking around before. Nick, are you allowed to tell us what you're working on? Or are you still in secret land?
Well, I'm allowed to say that I work with the hybrid cloud services group now.
Okay.
Which was announced recently.
Very good. So now you're now out of the secret VMware cloud, and you're now in the semi-secret VMware cloud world.
Yeah. I can't say what I'm doing or how it'll work out, but yes, I am working on the new hybrid cloud services, which has been announced and aggressively will compete against AWS and others.
Cool. Very cool. Well, good. Well, let's jump into this because I know we're sort of we want to make sure we stay on time. We are all joking around about trying to fit in podcasts and other stuff around our real boss's schedule. So first and foremost, Gene, you've got a brand new book out, a book called The Phoenix Project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, this is a project that I've been working on and off for about 10 years and full-time for about 3 years. And it's a novel. Well, the full title is The Phoenix Project, a novel about IT, DevOps, and helping your business win. And, you know, for me, it really is meant to model. It was modeled very closely after a book that had a huge influence on me. I mean, it's been the most influential book in my entire professional career, and was called The Goal. That was written by Dr. Eliyahu Goldratt in the 80s. And it was a novel about a plant manager who had to fix his cost and due date issues in 90 days. Otherwise, they shut the plant down. And so even though I've never worked in a plant, or I've certainly never managed a plant, I mean, just seeing the world through Alex's eyes was so eye-opening. And so even though I couldn't concretely say that I had actually been in that position before, I knew it was actually very important and that there were some lessons that was very important to me.
Okay.
And so basically the Phoenix Project is a novel about a reluctant VP of IT operations who has to fix his project due date issues, operational stability issues, security and compliance issues in 90 days. Otherwise, they're all going to get outsourced. And, I'm just delighted that the book is finally out, and I've been delighted with the feedback so far.
Good. Very good. Yeah, I had a chance to I wanted to be a good host, and so I went out and I got an excerpt of it, which I thought, okay, I'll get 15 or 20 pages. It was like half the book, which is good. I read through it, and I'll tell you, it's an interesting read. It's not your typical technical book, right? It's got characters in it, and it's got plot, and so it's about 170 pages of this guy just in all the miseries that you hear in IT. It's, you know, the development group doesn't get along with the operations group, and management doesn't really understand their problems, and then all of a sudden I got to the end and I was like, oh crap, Gene only gave me half the book. He didn't give me the part that talks about the fix.
So
it was a classic sort of teaser in it. But it, you know, from the parts that I've read so far, and obviously, you know, some folks that we've talked to in the past that have read it, you know, tons of people love the book.
And just excellent reviews on both Amazon and, yeah, like you said, on Twitter, the listeners that said they wanted it you on absolutely loved it.
Yeah, you know, I think in terms of the feedback, right now, it's been really interesting to me, and I think it was, you know, we actually specifically designed and constructed the book in this way, but I mean, still sort of like the response has been just overwhelmingly sort of validated sort of the approach, which is, you know, the reaction is primarily, holy cow, I recognize these characters, I recognize these problems, I recognize these disasters, right? And it comes from, you know, every kind of walk of life in IT, whether it's a startup or in an enterprise, and you know, I think more than anything, it sort of paints the futility and the hopelessness of status quo. When you don't have dev and ops working together, you're almost, you know, failure is almost preordained, right? And so not only does ops not win or dev not win, right, the business ultimately loses. And then the kind of the business survival mechanism is to outsource it, not realizing that, you know, IT is, you know, this core competency they must have. You know, IT, you know, the business, regardless of what business they think they're in, you know, is an IT company. And, you know, I think you see it, you know, in the numbers, right? 95% of capital projects have an IT component. You know, 50% of capital spending is IT related. So for any company, IT is not a currency, you know, is, you know, just an absurd assertion. So, you know, I think the book is really constructed to show that, you know, regardless of whether you're dev, ops, test, information security, you know, when you have large batch sizes, when you don't have these groups, you know, working together, that failure really is preordained. And, you know, I think it's been, you know, very interesting to sort of see the feedback. It's like, okay, I see the DevOps, you know, I now have the DevOps aha moment that I had, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And by the way, Nick, I will never forget hanging out with you at VMworld. That must have been 4 years ago, where we were sort of talking through some of the plot points of this and just that incredible head session we have about, like, what are the kind of critical components to get fast flow, you know, from dev into ops into production, you know, while preserving stability, reliability, security, and so forth.
Yeah, I it's funny how you can have a conversation 4 years later, remember it vividly, and it's funny how, you know, it's not that it was a huge part of it, but it's funny how watching the evolution of your thought processes and kind of the narrative you've written and how it's like you hooked on these core problems that have developed in the IT departments and in the flows, and it's funny how a lot of those things we talked about before, I can see the evolution of those ideas about what you were sharing now in the narrative, and it's awesome.
Yeah, no. So Gene, does that mean Nick gets a cut of the book proceeds?
It's already been arranged.
So I've got this question. So Aaron and I have been hanging around this this local technology kind of meetup thing. It's the local North Carolina DevOps group, and yeah. Everybody who's in that it's a lot of ex guys who are at Red Hat or you know, various sysadmin. It's a very sysadmin driven culture. It's a very Linux centric culture. And most of the guys that are there, their business is literally the technology they deliver. So, you know, it's a bunch of those companies. And so the thing that always comes up, and I was kind of contrasting this to what was in the book, is, you know, when you talk about DevOps, is DevOps only an environment where, like, the product that you deliver is technology? Or, I mean, does this have any applicability for sort of traditional IT that's not just developing their own stuff, they're using packaged stuff? I mean, is there a world for that, or is this really exclusively for folks that are developing their own software and the merger with them in operations?
So in the Phoenix project, the company that everyone's working for is this 150-year-old parts company called Parts Unlimited. You know, mm-hmm. They just make parts, right? The auto parts, and they have a retail joint. And so we specifically chose a company, a vertical, right, that was, you know, the lowest tech we could find, right? I mean, if we could have, and we actually were thinking about making a gravel manufacturer, a gravel crusher, right? But, you know, it didn't seem credible. And so, you know, our assertion is, and, you know, we're starting to gather the proof points to show that, you know, DevOps isn't just for the Twitters and the Etsys and the Googles and the Amazons and the Pinterests. You know, it's any place where you, where the business has a high reliance on IT, whether it's in the project delivery or in, you know, on the delivered services. And, you know, and I think that's basically every company these days. And, you know, it's not just for these kind of, you know, online services companies, it's for everybody. And I kind of view, you know, the world and, you know, the Amazon and the Pinterest, the Twitters, they're like the one percenters. You know, the 99 percenters, you know, are like the people in the enterprise. And, you know, I see DevOps as this ray of hope of how you can elevate, you know, the, you know, quality of life in IT everywhere, as well as, you know, dramatically improve, you know, throughput and productivity. And just to show you kind of, you know, how these patterns apply to the enterprise, I mean, they can be done on SAP, PeopleSoft, Oracle Financials, right? I mean, as long as you can sort of get things checked into version control, as long as you can automate the deployments, right? You know, you can do these things on even these more complex, more monolithic enterprise applications. There's a case study where HP basically applied many of these DevOps type principles. Obviously, they don't deploy to an online service, but they took the printer driver code from 87 models and merged it into one code base using many of the same techniques that used in continuous delivery and DevOps, like feature flag and so forth. And the amount of work that went done went through the roof, right? You don't have to spend so much time merging, testing, integrating. You know, now people can work on features, you know, as opposed to, you know, basically trying to get code to work and then, you know, deploy to a test environment. So if you can do it for a printer driver code, right? I mean, you can certainly do it for, you know, WebLogic, SAP, PeopleSoft, Oracle. And we're building up a set of case studies to show kind of exactly what techniques, you know, you need to actually put into place to make this work. And I want to acknowledge there's a lot more organizational kung fu that needs to happen to sort of influence all the right stakeholders and get them to sort of do things that in a way that's been different. That looks very different than the way things have been done before. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I think because that's always the discussion that goes on when people talk about, you know, cloud and web scale and kind of all the buzzwords these days is the, you know, the most prominent use cases always tend to be the web scale companies. It's Netflix. It's, you know, it's the ones that you mentioned. And it's always, you know, it's a lot of this other people trying to figure out, like, does that apply to me? Should I care about that? Should I go learn some of those tools and stuff? And I mean, like, Nick, I know you were, you know, prior to what you were doing before, even when you were at your old job before EMC and you were playing with Razor, like, you were trying to find that balance between just sort of the super modern stuff and, you know, how do I apply this to even, you know, Windows rollouts, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I've been doing these keynotes at VMUGs talking about automation. And at first I thought, oh, I'm just going to go and show off this cool tech. Look what Netflix is doing. Look what Etsy's doing. Look what GitHub's doing. Like, GitHub has some amazing cool new stuff they came out with. And then, you know, my friends over at Puppet Labs and Opscode, hey, look what these guys are doing and see how this benefits you. And then I realized really quickly that the disconnect is not actually the tech. The disconnect is why it's important. There's actually some patterns here. And I started to really focus more on the patterns and why this is important and what this does. And I think you know, Gene just hit on it with things like version control. Like, an old school sysadmin doesn't really understand version control on the ops side, right? He doesn't understand why it's important. But when you explain to him, you know, what version control does, and you explain to him what idempotent control of your scripts can do with Puppet and all these different things, you start explaining to, like, these modern advances that developers did to manage their change, to manage their dependencies and all this stuff. And why that is so important on the ops side, it's amazing the light bulb that goes off. I mean, I've had one debug up in Toronto where I first did the big keynote on automation and why it's important and what it brings. And when I talked about things like, you know, you have this 4,000 or 5,000 line PowerShell script and you replace it with this Puppet module and the differences there and what that does from an automation standpoint and continuous delivery and de-risking a bunch of stuff that eats a lot of your time. I mean, it was literally, there's people like shaking their heads in the audience and nodding and smiling. And it's just interesting how these are some really simple core principles to many people in, like, dev shops. But outside of the tech and the difficulty of it, it's actually not that hard to start going down some of these routes.
Yeah.
And let me add this too. I think you both hit on just a really key point is most people just really think DevOps doesn't apply to them, and they just never really dig into it. And compare that against, so Gene, kind of going back to one of your previous books, the Visible Ops Handbook, which is really more like ITIL focused, right? And And that is, at least, you know, seems to be in the industry kind of the exact opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to DevOps, right? And can you, like, for people that are unfamiliar, say, like, with DevOps or ITIL, like, compare and contrast the two of them very quickly, because the fact that you've written a book primarily on DevOps and a book primarily on ITIL, probably not many in the industry have done something like that.
That is, I kind of view DevOps is kind of this ecumenical movement, right, that sort of combines all the aspirations and goals of, like, the ITIL community, the service management community, the agile community, the service-oriented architecture people. And so in my mind, visible ops and service management, I mean, that was all about the control and eradication of unplanned work. I mean, that was a single sort of theme of visible ops, was like, how do you sort of, enable reliable service by, you know, creating known good builds and so forth, controlling changes and configurations. What DevOps is kind of the exact inverse. It's about how do you sort of manage the fast flow of planned work so it flows quickly through the system without causing, you know, chaos downstream. I see them as very complementary. And in fact, you know, I would say that a prerequisite for DevOps is you need to have a well managed controlled environment that can be versioned, that's consistent, and you know, that's only then can you actually have, you know, these high deploy rates that you associate with DevOps. By the way, how are we doing here, guys? Is this
we're doing great. We're doing great.
Okay, great. So I see them as perfectly consistent with each other, and in terms of, like, you know, empirical evidence that DevOps isn't just for the unicorns of Etsy and Google, right? It's BNY Mellon, Bank of America, World Bank, Paychex, right? So in the financial services, you got retailers like The Gap, GameStop, right? You got universities and higher education like University of Portland, Seton Hill University. So, you know, I think the goal of all this is to say, you know, DevOps is for all of us, you know, regardless of what industry we're in, whether we're, you know, what size of organization. These are like universal principles that apply to all of IT.
Yeah. Now, you know, you're writing this, but you guys are doing a bunch of research on this as well. As you're seeing people that are kind of adopting DevOps, being successful with it, do you find, because you talked a little earlier, like there's as much technology involved, or probably twice as much, you know, people, process, kind of organizational stuff. Do you find that people start sort of with it as a side project, kind of figure it out, and then use it as a lighthouse back to the rest of their organization? Or what are you seeing as a successful way for people to, kind of start this thing, especially if they're not a complete greenfield?
Yeah, I think it all starts. I think there's a reason why it kind of DevOps has a reputation of being bottom up, because it takes kind of the right relationships between what's that quote from a Star Trek 5-6, right? Only Nixon can go to China. I mean, it starts with that relationship between ops and dev, right? To say, hey, look, we have a shared goal, and the way we're working, you know, is counter to that. And, you know, one of them, Puppet Labs just released the 2012 State of DevOps survey. I just put that into the Skype window. Okay. And one of the, there are three things that predicts performance. One is, how long have you been doing DevOps? Two is, do you have the environment checked into version control? And three is, you know, do you have an automated process to build environment from scratch? Right. And those three things predict performance. But one of the strongest signals that predicted, you know, the four measures we were looking for, which is, code deploy rates, daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly, the lead time for changes, you know, how long do you have to wait from code commit to production, is it weeks, hours, weeks, months, quarters, you know, what is your change success rate, and what is your mean time to repair? One of the best predictors of all of those performance measures was, how long have you been working at DevOps? Right? I mean, literally, if you're not doing DevOps, 0.5% of that population, is in the high performer category, and something like 60%, if they've been working at DevOps for over a year, are in the high performer category. So it just shows that, the only way to get better is by trying, right? And it only to me, it was just a startling statistic.
It's a bit of the crawl, walk, run philosophy.
Yeah. And it's even more, I would say, just to maybe even go take that one step further, it's, you know, it's do painful things more frequently. It's like if you, so in other words, if we want to do this, we have to keep trying, as opposed to the person who says, oh my gosh, I just ran a mile, that was horrible, let's not do this, you know, as frequently, right? And, you know, if, I'm not sure what the outcome we're hoping for is, you know, we'll be better rested, right? It's, you know, the answer really is, you know, we got to run that mile, you know, more often, right? And that's the only way we're going to get better.
Well, it's, I mean, it's sort of like, it's like the Malcolm Gladwell book, the Outliers book, that says, you know, in order to become an expert at anything, it's about 10,000 hours, which, you know, if you work that out, that's probably, you know, that's about 5 years worth of straight working on it. But somewhere between,
right,
somewhere between probably year one and year two, if you're, if you put your mind to it, you know, you, you get to a point where that, that learning curve accelerates very, very quickly.
God, I love that. In fact, just to resonate with that, there's a, there's a growing school of thought, you know, that's, it's not only Malcolm Gladwell who wrote Outliers, but it's in sports training, it's in learning to play a musical instrument, it's in how the training is done in the special forces in the military.
Yep.
You know, the basic underlying principle is that it is better to practice 15 minutes a day every day than it is to practice once a week for 3 hours. That it's daily repetition creates the habits, and it's the habits that create changed outcomes.
So Gene, you know, one of the other things I picked up out of the book, and it was just a little bit in the half teaser portion that I got, but that's sort of intriguing to me. When the guy who's the potential board member comes to the guy who runs IT, and he says, I want to understand how you run, you know, how you do things, and they get to talking, and then he takes him over to a factory, or to the company's factory, and he kind of draws this analogy to, you know, the place in the factory where they're making parts, and in essence, he was talking about, in their case, raw material flow from whatever they were making through however it got shopped and tool and dyed out the door. And he tried to draw this analogy between, you know, information flow, you know, development flow, test flow, production flow. I mean, is that, you know, I mean, the manufacturing industry, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, when it was General Motors, and then there was all the Deming stuff and everything that happened with, say, like Toyota, and they got much more efficient. I mean, is that a common analogy you see drawn between what people are trying to do with DevOps and what we learned with Lean and Just-in-Time and Six Sigma and all those things in manufacturing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think kind of one of the, you know, many of the authorities cited in the DevOps community are like Deming, you know, theory of constraints and so forth. And one of the aspirations that we had with the book was to actually just take that a step further and create the isomorphic mapping between the plant floor in manufacturing and the IT value stream. And so we wanted to very concretely sort of map kind of what is the equivalent of a work center on the plant floor to IT. How about the bill of materials, the production schedule? And we actually found that very enlightening, because if we can make IT look like a manufacturing plant floor, then we can use all the tools and techniques, you know, from Lean, from, you know, the Toyota production system, from the theory of constraints, and, you know, derive kind of what those patterns of work should look like. And, you know, so, you know, for me, that was actually kind of one of the neatest part about writing the book, was to kind of create those very concrete mappings and, you know, show that, you know, IT knowledge work, right, isn't all about, you know, creativity and free form, right? Because actually, whenever you have recurring work, you know, that's actually very important to standardize, and, you know, that's what allows us to do planning. And by, you know, getting that work under control and reducing variance there, that's what actually allows, you know, the most creative work to happen. You know, to me, that was like one of the coolest parts of the book, was, you know, to really try to bring kind of our hero of the story through and get them to see, you know, see how IT is like the plant floor. And if Nick is there, I'd love to actually hear kind of his impressions on how effectively we did that.
I agree 100% with that. I mean, I think, you know, the funny thing is, it's been a while since I've been in a role. You know, Gene, when we first met, I was back as a customer, and I was dealing with a lot of the same issues that you've you know, actually a fraction of the issues you covered in the book. But now in my current role, I'm starting to get involved in those kind of things again. And it's interesting now, like coming, you know, 3 years later, going through being a vendor side, going through being, you know, pre-sales, all these other roles, coming back to being in a group that's actually going to run hardware, run software, and push out software releases. And I'm actually part of a team that's dealing with that thought process. And I've got to deal with ops. How much this matters to me more than it would have like a year or two ago when I wasn't dealing with it. And it's funny because the difference for me is the perspective of public cloud, where 4 years ago that was kind of not really a thing. And that actually leads me to a question back to you on that, and that I wanted to ask you was, so, I mean, the book obviously shows the value of IT as a core part of a business, right? And respecting that, understanding that, appreciating and putting effort and improving it. But how do you see cloud changing that with, what the, you know, with services like infrastructure as a service and platform as a service and consumables being exterior, not quite like outsourcing? How do you see that as affecting, you know, stuff like IT as a core and discipline and process improvement?
Gosh. Wow. Such a deep question. I'll take a stab at this, and I might be a little bit elusive. So I was talking with a friend of mine. His name is Charlie Betts. He's a longtime enterprise architect, and he and I were kind of the people who didn't quite fit in when we went to the ISIL conferences, you know, 10 years ago. And, you know, we were both sort of in a similar circle that we're both kind of longtime ISIL practitioners and sort of now DevOps, you know, zealots. And, you know, I think one of the biggest sort of hurdles for adoption of DevOps in the enterprise is to get sort of like these silos and these, you know, centers of excellence that own, like, you know, a platform or own, like, specific skills, like the DBA team or the network engineering team, and to say, you know, get them out of the piecework business, right, saying that, you know, we're not paying them for their time, right, to do work. What we really want them to do is, you know, put their user knowledge and create things that other people can do instead of them, right? So, you know, we want them to build the automation mechanisms that allow kind of anybody to do their work, right? And it's not to get rid of their job, it's to get them into the, you know, systems engineering business as opposed to the operator business. And so once that happens, you know, I think that's when you get these kind of, that's when a thousand flowers can bloom, right? It's like if you can create sort of platform as a service, if the operations can do that, then they can leverage all the public cloud infrastructure out there. You know, we can actually, you know, allow a level of empowerment and self-service that never would have existed 5 years ago. So I think that is very, very consistent, and just, I fear, you know, at the risk of sounding elusive, I think 10 years ago, you know, the outsourcing boom, we thought we could outsource people and have the right things happen. I think, you know, more and more we're finding that almost it is very, very difficult to actually outsource IT and kind of get the right kind of DevOps style dynamics, because now you have a profit motive of the people being outsourced. I think what will work is, you know, when you can leverage all these sort of things like public cloud, these online services, and, you know, I think that is what's kind of enabling this kind of incredible blossoming of, like, innovation that, you know, the likes of we haven't seen in 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Is that resonating with you?
Maybe. Yeah, and really you're looking at, in that instance, you know, DevOps isn't just about, you know, being more efficient or going faster. It's actually about doing innovative things that just wouldn't be possible because you're kind of bogged down in minutiae otherwise.
Right, exactly. And so we sort of framed the principles, you know, as the three ways, right? So this is meant to be the three principles of which you could derive all the DevOps patterns from, and for that matter, probably all of the lean techniques from. And so the first way is all about the left to right flow of work. You know, you go from development to operations. And that, you know, the goal there would say, you know, is always to increase flow from left to right, from dev to ops. And so while the DevOps practitioners would talk about, like, deploy rates, right, I think the real important metric is, like, cycle time. How long does it take you to go from, you know, code commit into production? And, you know, I think one of the concrete patterns that come out of that is, you know, having environments available on demand, right? So whether it's right-clicking inside of a virtual center and recreating a production environment, or a one-step automated build process using Shepherd Puppet. I mean, no longer is it acceptable to wait 6 months for a test environment, right? You know, that has to be able to be done on demand. You know, so the second way is all about sort of shortening and amplifying feedback loops as you go from right to left. So the first way is left to right, from dev to ops. The second way is right to left, from ops into dev. And I think the concrete pattern that you can, you know, derive from that is, you know, waking up developers at 2 a.m. Patrick Lightbody said when he founded a company called Browser Mob. It was kind of one of the first cloud-based load testing tools. He said, we found that when we woke developers up at 2 a.m., you know, defects got fixed faster than ever, right? It just says that, you know, developers or anyone upstream has to live with the consequences made downstream. In other words, people downstream, you have to share the pain. And then the third way is all about sort of how do you have a culture that allows for continual experimentation and taking risks, but also valuing repetition as a prerequisite to mastery. And that's where we get into things like, you know, practicing daily drills. In fact, the whole Netflix chaos monkey, you know, of like, injecting faults into the production environment, I think is a direct, you know, could be directly derived from the third way. So, you know, that is as true for the IT value stream as it is in manufacturing. And, you know, I think once we get the people and process down, that's when we can fully exploit things like, you know, cloud, like private cloud, hybrid cloud, you know, because that's now sort of focusing on the work center, not the person.
You know, I want to hit on something you said there. So, you know, one of these days people will know what's going on, but, you know, 7 months ago I started in the role I'm in now, and I've had the opportunity to build a team. And one of the cool, we actually have a set of core values. One of our core values is that we accept failure. We actually love failure. Failure is awesome. The great thing about failure is you know when it happens and you can figure out how it happened, which means you can quantify it, adjust it, replace it with non-failure. But it's not knowing when things fail. It's not understanding. It's the mystery of it that drives fear and is what we get, what we hate. And so a lot of our coding style, a lot of the way we approach things is let's fail things out so we can at least see where things fail. And that, like the Chaos Monkey stuff is a great example of what we look at, and we see that and we say this is awesome, because we're saying we understand that this isn't perfect, right? I mean, it's not an art of trying to build a perfect thing. It's that Kaizen iteration of let's get better, let's improve it, let's make it faster, let's make it deploy quicker, let's focus on features over other stuff.
Yeah,
how do you,
I love that.
How do you, I mean,
but can I just resonate?
Yeah, go ahead, absolutely.
Just test something off of you. So I think one of the prerequisites we're writing kind of the DevOps cookbook, you know, is that you not only want to, you know, focus on sort of transparency and taking risks, but then we also need it seems like there's this other thing that we also need, which is like maintaining the integrity of the system of work. In other words, like, you know, you have a continual build system, you have continual testing, you have continual integration and continual deployment. And if someone breaks the build, well, then no one checks in code until we fix the build again, right? And so to me, it's this interesting dichotomy where it's all about taking risks, but if someone does something that jeopardizes the system, you fix the system before allowing new work to come in. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I don't know. The big thing is that's really starting to really resonate with me is there needs to be a, and you said it earlier in the call, there's this idea of there's no me versus you in this scenario, right? That we're on the same team. So it's not a matter of me finding a way to press, you know, push the fault off of me and put it on you as a dev or an ops guy. It's the understanding that accountability across borders and in the understanding that we all were working for the same goal. I mean, I think it's a core piece of what DevOps is, but I think there's like machinations and there's patterns that you can implement that don't enforce that. It's like the GitHub guys, and they're like amazing IAM tool, right? Which just blows my mind. And it's that fact of annoying accountability and the waking up at 2 a.m. and the everybody's working together. It's like everybody's responsible at the same time kind of thing. And I know it's easy to say that, but the benefits of that are immense. You get that startup style accountability in bigger shops. You get the startup style agility in the bigger shops.
And actually, Nick, that leads to something else in the fact that you know, DevOps a lot of times, at least from an operations side of the house, a lot of people start asking a lot of questions of, well, you know, does this represent almost like a power shift, or who's really in charge? And a lot of concepts around, you know, change is scary or change is bad, but in this instance, it isn't that way, and it is something that has to be embraced.
Well, it's a cost-benefit thing, right? I mean, honestly, change is awesome because change drives business value. And I shouldn't say across the board, but, you know, the initial concept of change is, if we can do this, we can make more money. Or if we do this, we can do things in a shorter amount of time. If we do this, things get better. It's that iterative cycle. If we try to improve something, we do it, we look at it, we figure out how we can do it better, we do it again. We do it, we look at it, we think about how we can do it better, we do it again. So change as a proper process is amazing. It's just, going back to the visible ops days, it's just doing change the wrong way is dangerous. And I think Gene hit it again when he said it's approaching it from a different angle. And I think it's like, you know, how you sharpen a pencil, right? So the visible ops was sharpening the pencil one way, you know, unnecessary change, unaccounted for change. And DevOps is sharpening the pencil the other way, enabling change to be continuous and accelerated. And I think there's a balance to it.
So,
you know, I would say that kind of, in my mind, there's kind of two motivations. You know, that if someone were saying, gosh, why, if someone sort of hears DevOps and rolls their eyes, you know, I would actually sort of, in my mind, there's two sort of relevant things that, you know, they should be aware of. One is anyone who has to live downstream of the effects, anyone who is downstream and has to live with, you know, the daily consequences of decisions made upstream, you know, there's actually damage done to that person, right? Because we deprive that person of control. And, you know, a friend of mine, Josh Corman, he did a study of the information security community around burnout. And they found that information security, and I'm betting ops people will be almost the same way, rated higher in burnout than trauma physicians in emergency medical care, first responders, and people doing multiple tours of duty, you know, in wartime. And then the signs of burnout are fatigue, cynicism, and illusions of self-efficacy, right? And so I think, you know, cynicism for many of us is a core competency. So, you know, I think when we feel trapped in a system that preordains failure and we are powerless to change the outcomes, I mean, I think that is one of the worst things we could actually do to another human being. And ops and information security, I think, bear the brunt of that. So, you know, imagine if there was a better way to work, you know, with our dev partners and actually have shared goals. I mean, I think it really is, you know, a game changer. And I think the second thing is what Nick was saying, is the economic benefits of, you know, DevOps style practices is, you know, enormous. A co-author and I, we did this calculation that we just wanted to say, what is the business value that is on the table for us to be able to capture if we just have the amount of waste associated with the IT value stream and deploy it in a way where we get 5 times the value back? The number we came up with was $2.6 trillion per year. So, I mean, that's like such a huge number, right? That's more than the entire economic output of Germany. So, you know, so someone's going to take that, right? Whether it's, you know, us or our competitors, right? For the business people, you know, that would be the message I would broadcast. The next point is that, you know, there's $2.6 trillion of economic value that's going to get recaptured. You know, who's going to take it? And that is a zero-sum game.
And going back to your first point, what is the amount of loss of talent due to an improper process? You have some person who is highly talented, who's very effective, who is an asset, and maybe you invested years in them, but because of the nature of the processes and someone upstream stepping on them to a point where they get burned out and they move on, and you having to backfill them. And what's the sunk cost in just churn from replacing people that you should have never lost in the first place?
Exactly. I mean, it is incalculable. And by the way, those are the problems that sort of cause people to go home, and you know the people around them suffer as a result, right? I mean, you know, that's our families, you know, that's our kids, right? You have to deal with the person who's stressed out due to something that you know they can't control. I mean, it's kind of unfair.
Yeah, no, I can speak firsthand to that, having worked in the Cisco TAC for about 2 years, getting beaten up all day long, nothing but stuff is broken. it mentally wears on you. I mean, it takes a toll, and yeah, I mean, the life of how long people stay in those jobs was about 2 years. So, I mean, you have this terrible burden of you need to hire people, you need to recruit, you need to hire, you need to train them. They're only going to stick around for a certain period of time. All the knowledge that they've accumulated goes out the door after 2 years or some period like that, because there is no better, there's no way to slow down the flow of you know, broken stuff.
And think about what we talked about before about the 2013 results from Puppet Labs on DevOps, and a lot of the longer you do it, the longer you practice at it, right? It goes back to what Gene said about running. I mean, the longer you run, the better you get. But it's very difficult to build that momentum if you're losing the people that are learning the practices, right? And so it's that whole thing. There's an iterative benefit to you switch the practices, you improve the morale, the people stay, they get better at it. You improve the practices, they get happier, they stay. You feed the cycle of improvement inside your own org.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, you know, this sort of discussion more and more. I mean, there's a part of this discussion where, you know, if we had this in front of a large group of people, you'd have a bunch of folks who would go, that'll never happen, you can't change that. And, you know, those folks probably would tend to be, you know, today's IT operations people. And I think that's, I don't say that in a mean way. I highlight that because I think that's probably one of the number one causes why we have so much sort of shadow IT, if you will, or people going around IT. It's because, you know, it's not shadow IT always comes out of, like, you know, IT is bad and the developers have got it figured out, or the business units. I mean, it's people just have things to get done. And so I think what ends up happening is the ops part of DevOps for a lot of corporations is somebody else's public cloud or somebody else's service, and the developers then go, good, I can go get this stuff and I can make that work. I think it's a much harder thing for the ops guys to figure out how to make those changes, because right now they're on the end of the stick that's always looking bad. You know, like it's hard for them to figure out a way to accelerate stuff typically.
Well, think about it too, like juxtapose that versus back when Agile was first introduced, right? And people came at, you know, developers and said, hey, check out Agile, we can do it this way, and you could have a much more of a bigger investment in what you're doing on a day-to-day basis and less micromanaging by project managers and all this and this. I'm sure the developers back then, and I'm way too young to be able to speak to that, but I'm sure the developers back then were saying, yeah, but that's never going to happen, right? I mean, the same thing has probably been said before.
Yep, yep.
You know, I'm just putting it for the cynics out there, right? I mean, I think some of the most inspirational stories about sort of IT transformation I've ever seen was a talk by Michael Rametsi and Patrick McDonald at Etsy. And, you know, it was a year-by-year kind of, you know, play-by-play story of, like, you know, how they went from 2008 of the year. I mean, I love this quote from this their talk. It's like, the year we realized, they call it the year of pain and living in the sea of our engineering filth. the story begins, like, after, like, one deploy that was so bad, you know, that Betsy kind of went home going, I'm not sure if I can do another deploy again. You know, every year, kind of what they tackled, and it was just, just listening to this talk, and it's just this magnificent story of, like, kind of the, of how things, you know, how they made their environment better, and how they, you know, work more closely with development and ultimately help the business win. It's one of my favorite. There's like 120 reviews on Amazon now. I'm just like delighted by this. But one of my favorite, one of the ones that stands out in my memory is one that says, the Phoenix Project is like, it gets better for IT. It's like a montage of, like, all the things that go wrong. It's like almost everything that can go wrong in IT, right? But it kind of shows that there is a way out, right? It can get better, but it really does take, you know, the collective will to say, hey, this is our problem. We have to fix it and build that coalition to make it so.
Well, listen, guys, we've had a very, very good conversation. I have a feeling we probably could keep going for another hour, so we could make a part two of this. But with respect to everybody's time, I know Aaron's got crazy stuff going on in the background. Nick is walking around his backyard talking to his laptop, and we've had connection challenges. But the conversation's been great. Gene, you're out and about all the time. Where can people expect to find you, I don't know, in the next couple of months if they want to connect with you, buy you a beer, buy you a drink, talk about this stuff?
Let's see here. So the place I'll be really excited about going is I'm going to be at the Mountain West Ruby Conference in Salt Lake City. I'm going to be at Source Boston and the DevOps Meetup in New York City, and then ChefConf later that week, and then DevOps Days Austin. Oh, by the way, if anyone hasn't gotten a chance to go to one of the DevOps Days, I would say make time to go. It is one of the most vibrant communities I've ever seen. And whether you're in ops or dev or test or information security, you just have to go to one of these because I think just even going will be as invigorating and maybe even give you a cause for hope. That was very much like going to the Velocity Conference, for me. So, get out to a DevOps Days.
Excellent.
Awesome. Very cool.
So, and of course, you can always find Gene at Real Gene Kim on Twitter and on his website. We'll have all that in the show notes. Well, folks, I think we're going to wrap it up for tonight. It's been a great conversation. We're going to put a couple of additional links in the show notes for some stuff that Gene's been sending us as we're going along, things to go back and refer to. But Aaron, you want to take us out? Or you want me to take us out?
Sure, I can do it this week. So, if you like the show, please tell a friend or leave us a review on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at TheCloudCastNet or on the web at TheCloudCast.net, where you can find links to everything CloudCast. Thanks, Gene, thanks, Nick, and thanks to everyone for listening.